Progressive.com.
Welcome to Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. This hour, we're going to look at a number of important environmental bills in the Florida legislature. Our guest is the State Director of Environment Florida, so I want you to tell us, what are some environmental stories that we should let people know about? So give us a shout. We'll take your calls. Here's the number, 813-239-9663. You can also email DJ at WMNF.org. You can text 813-433-0885. But first, I'm going to bring you two comments that were left by our listeners after last week's show. Our guest was the new CEO of HART, the Hillsborough Area Regional Transit Authority. Here are two people commenting about last week's show.
Hey, Sean, this is Smitty from Tampa. I called in. I just wanted to hear the answer. The CEO of Heartline did my question. I asked three questions. Get them spiffy-looking uniforms. Get them a name tag, big name tag. And get them to learn good introductory skills. Next time you have them on, ask them if you could answer that. Good show. But you kind of get those guys to answer the tough questions. See ya.
Hi, Sean. I'm calling because I'm curious if you're giving any attention to the allegations of the Russians changing the votes in the 2016 election and all of the stories of the vote rigging and vote fraud that have gone on in the 2016 and 2018 elections. There's some interesting video that's just come out today again by Project Veritas, exposing people voting in Florida and their home state that are snowbirds. People that come to Florida in the wintertime go back to their home state up north in the summertime, and they vote in both states. Okay, Sean, we'll listen to your program, and hopefully you'll put some coverage into these stories. Thank you.
Well, those were two listeners commenting about our last show, and it's on our website, WMNF.org. If you'd like to listen to it later on in the broadcast, I'll give out the number for you to leave a voicemail about today's show. You can always listen to previous shows, comment on the stories on our website. You can join us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at WMNF News. And we would like you to participate in today's show. The number to call in is 813-239-9663. You can email DJ at WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. My name is Sean Canaan. You're listening to 88.5 FM at 12:08 in the afternoon. This is Midpoint Monday, and my guest right now is Jennifer Rubiello. She's the State Director of Environment Florida. Welcome back to WMNF's Midpoint, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
So glad you can join us. Well, we're going to talk about a lot of different environmental stories that are happening in the Florida legislature. And one that is really close to home here in Hillsborough County is lead in the drinking water of public schools. So what, lay out the problem for us. What do we know about how much lead there is and how widespread a problem this is? Mm-hmm. And what one of our senators, Senator Janet Cruz of Tampa, is trying to do about it in the legislature.
Absolutely. Well, Sean, most states right now are failing to protect children from lead in schools' drinking water, and Florida is just absolutely no exception. We recently analyzed policies in 32 states for protecting children from lead exposure, and unfortunately, Florida earned an F for failing to have any policies on the books requiring testing or proactively preventing lead contamination in school or daycare drinking water. And, you know, really few school systems across our state have done significant testing for lead in drinking water. And where they have tested, they found unsettling results. And that's why this is so important. For example, here in Hillsborough County, since the school district started lead testing last year, 54 schools have tested above 15 parts per billion, which is the federal standard for action. And in one elementary school, even last year, they found two water fountains at the school tested nearly 4 and 5 times above the federal standard. And then in addition, even like in Polk County nearby, schools in Florida showed elevated levels of lead. So honestly, that's just likely the tip of the iceberg. The reality is there is no safe level of lead, especially for children.
So what is the legislature trying to do about it, and how likely will something be to pass this term?
Well, thankfully, we have some clear solutions. Senator Janet Cruz here in Hillsborough County has filed a bill this session, Senate Bill 66, that would have essentially installed filters that reduce lead in drinking water, particularly in schools built before 1986 when the law changed. Thankfully, the bill did pass. It's for the Senate Education Committee earlier this month unanimously. And really, the legislature is right now missing an opportunity to really move this bill forward. So it's really important now more than ever that local folks not only weigh in with their state elected officials here in Hillsborough County, but also across the state to ensure that our legislators know that protecting kids from lead exposure is a critical priority.
You spend a lot of time in Tallahassee at the legislature, but a lot of our listeners, and I don't, people might hear, oh, it passed the committee unanimously. That's great. Everything's going smoothly. But there seems to be a holdup. What's the holdup? What can you tell us that we might not know about how something passes unanimously through a committee, yet it still is not certain that it's going to go any further?
Sure. Well, the way the process works is when bills are filed for the first time ever, this is the first time a bill tackling this issue has been filed. So in that sense, Senator Cruz's leadership and just bringing up tackling this issue is really important for moving the conversation forward. The fact that it did pass unanimously in the first step of the process is significant and important. And it shows, one, the degree to which this is a significant problem. And two, I think the consensus around wanting to tackle the issue. But the reality is unless there's lots of public support for making this a priority amongst a lot of other issues, we're going to need that to ultimately make sure that kids are safe when they're drinking water at school. Certainly, this is something, again, that is a pretty easy fix. So there's no reason why the legislature shouldn't be able to tackle it, if not this year, certainly next year.
And that was Senate Bill 66, you said? And so if people are interested in this issue, they can contact their legislators and say that they support or oppose SB 66, sponsored by Janet Cruz of Tampa. Before we move on to other legislative issues, is there anything else we need to note about this lead in drinking water of public schools?
I mean, no, that's the key thing. I think, again, the one thing to point out that is important to understand is that any amount, according to the American Academy of Pediatricians, any amount of lead exposure for kids is really unsafe. So the federal standard is 15 parts per billion. They actually deem that one part per billion is really the beyond that is unsafe for kids. So even our federal standard is really not quite good enough. And so that's why the best solution to tackle this problem is really actually to remove the faucets and fixtures and replace the pipes. Obviously, that's a big investment, a critical investment, but a big investment. In the interim, one thing we can do, and that's what this bill, Senator Cruz's bill, would do, is at least install filters and faucets where food is made and water is used, and also drinking water fountains, so that we're at least filtering out some of the lead.
Senate Bill 66. So our guest is Jennifer Rubiello, with the State Director of Environment Florida, and you're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. My name is Sean Canaan. You're listening to Midpoint on WMNF, and I'm going to go to the phones in just a second. Let me read a question that came in. Actually, that's not about this show, so I'm going to go straight to the phone. And Gary in Dunedin has been holding a while. Hi, Gary. What would you like to ask?
Yeah, first of all, I thank anyone who's trying to protect Florida's environment. I was born and raised here in Pinellas, and it's been a massacre. It's been an ecocide, and that's happening statewide. And I think it's great to talk about lead and all these things, but in some ways, unless we talk about stopping population growth and development and boating and fishing in Florida, then we're just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. This state has an ecological carrying capacity that was long ago exceeded. Every tree cut down, every new house built, every road expanded, every new subdivision is a destruction of native Florida habitat, animals, plants, and trees, and that's all there is to it. And I don't understand why more environmental advocates don't say we've got to shut the door on population growth. And indeed, the only way to truly restore even a fraction of the paradise that Florida used to be ecologically and socially and quality of life-wise would be to stop population growth and depopulate Florida. Nobody ever talks about it, and it seems to me like a delusion not to, and a detour. So I would like to hear your guest comment about that.
All right, Gary, thanks so much for that thoughts. Those thoughts. We're going to hear a lot more about growth and development in the state during this hour, and especially in the next few minutes. So, Jennifer, what would you say about Gary's thoughts?
Growth is a huge in development. I would agree. Growth and development are both enormous problems and some really arguably one of the biggest challenges facing the state. We have to drastically rethink how we organize our community and construct our communities here in Florida to be less sprawl and more density. We also need more public transportation, right? We need to focus more on investing in density and public transit, walkable communities, than massive sprawl, tollways, et cetera. Because with roads and tollways, unfortunately, comes more development, more water, more pressures put on our conservation lands and wild open spaces, when really we should be thinking about density and improving our urban areas to have more public transit and to accommodate more people.
And we'll talk more about growth as we go through the show, but right now I'm going to turn to a story from Florida Public Radio. I just want to remind you that you are listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa, WMNF.org, and there are proposed toll roads through wild Florida. Florida Senate President Bill Galvano wants to see three major highways extended to more rural areas of the state in an effort to drive investment into those areas. But we're going to hear a story right now from Lynn Hatter, and we'll be right back after that. So stay tuned for a second. We'll talk more about this story, and we'll take your phone calls in just a second. Florida Public Radio's Lynn Hatter reports, as this plan gains traction, it's unclear whether those roads will ever be built.
Galvano unveiled his idea earlier this year.
I think we can improve evacuation, access to our rural communities, multi-purpose corridor access.
The project is expected to cost billions of dollars. It was initially panned by Governor Ron DeSantis over the planned use of tolls, and House Speaker Jose Oliva labeled it a budget issue.
What's the update on how the chamber views that priority of his over there? Is there going to be legislation, or how are you viewing that?
I think that's probably going to be more of a budget issue than it is legislative.
The plan got moving in recent weeks, right as Oliva's health care reform efforts began moving in the Senate. The speaker did not say whether the two were linked, but
he understands what's important to us. We understand what's important to him.
Galvano envisions extending the Suncoast Parkway from the Tampa Bay area to the Georgia border and stretching the Florida Turnpike west to connect with the Suncoast Parkway, as well as building the Heartland Parkway to run from Polk County down to Collier. But not everyone wants those new roads.
We think that using intelligent land planning, particularly for new development, and putting it in places where it will be less susceptible to severe weather is much better than having the world's longest parking lot.
The highway extensions have raised concerns from environmentalists like the Sierra Club's Dave Cullen. He does not think the environmental impact is worth the cost and calls the plan a recipe for sprawl. Meanwhile, rural communities say they weren't asked for their input either. In a recent hearing of the measure, Republican Senator Tom Lee appeared to address those concerns by explaining the creation of three task forces made up of local and state officials and environmentalists who'd examine whether the roads are doable. And if the task forces say no,
there is nothing in this legislation. It's self-executing. All of the feasibility analyses for ridership and the ability to sink any debt service associated with the construction of these facilities will have to be done successfully, failing which these projects, would be deemed not feasible.
The plan calls for rerouting $135 million in public tax money into the state's infrastructure trust fund over 3 years. $30 million of that would fund other infrastructure projects in rural areas.
$10 million annually to the small county road assistance program, $10 million annually for the small county outreach program to help connectors to these facilities that we're considering under this bill, and $10 million of transportation disadvantaged program for similarly related services.
Lee says the projects have been discussed for years, and he acknowledges they're controversial. The Florida Chamber of Commerce and the Builders and Trucking Associations are backing the bill. If the plans pass muster with task forces and are eventually approved, construction could begin as early as 2022. The task forces would deliver their reports next summer. I'm Lynn Hatter.
Well, that was a report from Lynn Hatter from Florida Public Radio about plans to potentially build toll roads through a lot of rural Florida. And so I do want to hear what you have to say about that. And our guest has a lot to say about that bill as well. The number here is 813-239-9663. You're listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF Tampa, WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan, and my guest is Jennifer Rubiello, the State Director of Environment Florida. There was also a column in the Tampa Bay Times recently opposing this plan to build new toll roads north of Tampa, east of Tampa, all through the state, all through the rural parts of the state. And it was by someone from the Sierra Club, Tim Martin, a conservation chair of the Florida chapter of the Sierra Club. And it was very critical of this plan. And you agree that you oppose this plan. Why?
Well, definitely the Tim Martin's op-ed was, I think, brought up a lot of really important considerations that I think should be that should be considered more critically in the state legislature right now. When we have historically built tollways and expressways, it has been the gateway towards more development. And as we've seen in the last few years with some of our water quality challenges, sprawl and development is damaging to our conservation lands. It puts a stress and a burden on our water resources. And ultimately, if we are going to be more resilient as a state, we need to rethink again how we build cities and how we expand. We need to protect conservation lands in areas like north of Tampa Bay, that whole region up along the Gulf Coast for future generations. And instead, we need to be investing more in our cities to have denser areas with more public transit. That's not only good for water quality, frankly, but it's also better for climate change, right? The more that we're building communities that are spread out, that lack public transit, that incentivize a car culture that is currently not electric, the more we're actually fueling climate change, which is the biggest threat that Florida is facing right now.
Our guest is Jennifer Rubiello with Environment Florida. And in this op-ed by Tim Martin of the Sierra Club, he talks about things like that these roads potentially will be built over wetland aquifer recharge areas, over recreation areas, over wildlife habitats, which will lead to fragmenting habitat, isolating wildlife corridors, contribute to deforestation, and eliminating wetlands. Also, I want to get into this part about whether these toll roads would be self-funding. Now, for those of us who are familiar with the English language, self-funding would kind of mean like that the road would pay for itself. But in this op-ed, Tim Martin points out that Florida tax dollars would be spent to build these roadways, but it's just a loophole to get through some regulatory hurdles. He says that by proposing self-funding toll roads, the state is looking to avoid more stringent federal road construction permitting requirements for transportation needs and economic feasibility studies. So that means that these roads can be built without deciding whether there is a need for it or whether it's cost effective. And also likely any federal environmental impact studies. So we won't know whether these roads will affect the environment. So those are pretty big hurdles, especially when it seems like it doesn't make sense that they're to call these roads self-funding when the Florida taxpayers would be on the hook to pay for them.
Absolutely. And these points need to be discussed more in my opinion and those of others currently before this plan really moves through. And so again, Tim Zoppet, I think, brings up a lot of these critical pieces. Big picture, again, we have to move away from just sprawling all across the state, and we have to think more thoughtfully and strategically about creating more resilient, dense communities.
Those bills are SB 7068 and HB 7113. They're called the Transportation Corridors bills. So if you're interested in those, look those up, SB 7068, HB 7113, Transportation Corridor bills. I want to move on to a text that we got, or an email from David out there in cyberspace. And David writes, I was wondering if your guests could speak about water quality issues in the North Florida springs. I took two trips to some springs along the Suwannee River in the fall and the spring, and both times many of the springs were browned out and unavailable for swimming due to high water levels on the Suwannee. I was surprised by brownouts occurring even in the dry season. Is this a major environmental concern? So we'll get to David's question, but let's talk about why would a spring be browned out if there's high water levels in the Suwannee River? So the Suwannee River has tannins in it because of the cypress trees. And so I guess if it gets too high, if the water levels in there get too high, it flows back into the springs instead of having the nice clear water coming out of the springs. But what can you say in general about the health of the springs and what the Florida legislators are doing about that?
Sure. Well, one thing that's a big issue, and it's currently being discussed right now at the state level, is agricultural nutrient pollution. That accounts for more than twice as much nitrogen loading than spring sheds, than wastewater treatment, essentially. Mm-hmm. So agricultural pollution is a huge, a really significant source of pollution for our springs and our water systems in general. So as the as we think about protecting our water quality, we need to think about how we're growing our food, right? We need to ensure that when we're growing food, putting fertilizer on agricultural lands, that we have mechanisms that ensure that when it rains, for example, and this fertilizer is on fields, that it doesn't just wash into our rivers and our waterways, and then ultimately our springs. And there are some things that the legislature could do to tackle that issue. They're currently being discussed, and I would recommend folks look into the Florida Springs Institute today, even to look at some actions that people can take to protect our springs.
Our guest is Jennifer Rubiello, with the Director of Environment Florida. We're talking about all things environment in the Florida legislature today. And you can email us at dj@wmnf.org, text 813-433-0885. You can call 813-239-9663. I have a couple of people on the line. I'm going to ask you to hold just for a second longer because we have some other topics we're going to talk about. We're a topic or two right now before we go to the phones again. It's 1228 in the morning. You're listening to 88.5 FM or wmnf.org. You might also be watching on Facebook Live, facebook.com/WMNF News. So thank you for joining us if you're there. Let me ask you this about last week. I talked to some environmentalists about the potential of offshore oil and gas drilling near Florida's coasts, the Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico. Potentially the Trump administration wants to open these up. Floridians in general are against this, mm-hmm. but the federal government might open this up. And this has become more likely now that last Thursday, the Interior Secretary was confirmed. And his name is David Bernhardt. What can you say about the likelihood of the potential of oil drilling occurring off of Florida's coast, and what your opinions are, the environmental impact that would be?
Sure. Well, the offshore drilling has so far always been a potential threat off of our coasts, despite the overwhelming opposition, as you mentioned, amongst Floridians to drilling both near our shores and offshore. And unfortunately, The federal plan that would that regulates drilling essentially could include the Eastern Gulf of Mexico. It could include the Atlantic. Signs are signaling that, and so now it's really more important than ever that the bipartisan opposition that has been strong for really years and almost decades now is elevated. I mean, we both, you know, the governor of Florida, current senator, U.S. senator, and then local communities all across the state do not want drilling off of our coast. It doesn't. I think most of us who were here can remember the 2010 Deepwater Horizon disaster and the impact that that had both on our local economies and our wildlife. And we're still living with some of those consequences to this day. So it's more important than ever to contact your U.S. Elected officials, so members of Congress, U.S. senators, and tell them that you still oppose drilling off of our coasts.
Is there an organization, is there legislation, for lack of a better word, in Tallahassee that says, you know, hey, federal government, we don't want you to drill off the coast of Florida? Is that something that legislators are looking at right now?
There's actually a resolution that is moving through the legislature that would, it's a resolution that signals to the federal government that the state legislature opposes drilling in the eastern Gulf of Mexico, in large part because of how important it is for the military.
Where does that stand? Is it getting support and isn't moving through committees?
It is moving through committees. It is getting support. So actually, State Senator Ed Hooper is the Senate sponsor for that bill here in Tampa Bay.
And it would be non-binding. It's just a kind of a statement of our preference as a state.
Exactly.
Our guest is Jennifer Rubiello. With Environment Florida. You're listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF.org. It's 12:31 in the afternoon, and we should probably go to the phones because DeAndre has been holding for a long time. Thank you for holding, DeAndre, in Riverview.
Thank you, Ms. Rubiello. And sir, I'm calling because I didn't hear about the radon. Is that also being made a part of any action in Tallahassee? Because there has been this radon detection around Hillsborough County. I'm not certain about others, but I was wondering if that's been worded into any legislation at all.
You know, not that I know of.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, good question. Thank you. I'll look into it as well, DeAndre, and I'll put the answer online if I can find anything about it, but I don't recall hearing anything about that. So I appreciate that question. Thanks so much for calling. If you'd like to join the conversation, 813-239-9663. You can email DJ at WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. Zach is writing about pollution, and it's possible, he wrote in before we talked about it, so it's possible that we may have covered some of this, but let me read what Zach writes in Riverview. 4 years ago, I moved to Riverview near I-75 and Gibsonton Drive. I immediately noticed a strong odor every 2 to 3 days. Mm-hmm. I also noticed whenever one of us would come in from outside, we would have a strong odor. Sometimes it would smell like industrial oil, sometimes like a wet dog, but mostly somewhere in between. I did a little research and realized it's when the wind blows from the west, which is directly from Mosaic. I looked up the history of the Mosaic plant on the Alafaya River. Horrible and scary. I'm afraid for my family's health. Can anything be done, or are there political, or are political donations more important? So I get, they're political donations. So political donations from Mosaic, are they more important than his health, is what Zach in Riverview is writing.
Phosphate mining is Florida's dirty secret, I would say. It's definitely has an impact on our waterways and on our communities. And I would definitely encourage him. The Center for Biological Diversity, actually, Rachel Curran, I'll be moderating a panel on April 26th in St. Petersburg, where that will likely be one of the issues we'll discuss. So definitely encourage him to attend. We'll be having a longer discussion about it.
Where and when?
At Allendale Church, April 26th, 6:30. It'll be one of many environmental topics discussed.
Allendale United Methodist Church, is that on 38th Avenue North?
Correct.
Nearish to MLK Drive.
And MLK and 38th, yeah. Just about, yep.
All right, well, so that's April 26th at 6:30 in St. Petersburg. It's kind of far from Riverview, but maybe you could make it out there and learn some things. All right, thanks so much for that email, Zach. I appreciate that. You're listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF.org. My name is Sean Canaan. My guest is Jennifer Rubiello, Director of Environment Florida. And let's talk about fracking. In the state legislature, there is what's known as a fracking ban, and that's advancing. I don't think it's passed. It certainly hasn't been signed or anything by the governor, but there's a ban on fracking, some types of fracking, including hydraulic fracturing, but there is no ban on something called matrix acidizing. What can you tell us about fracking and why your group would like matrix acidizing to be part of the fracking ban? And I hope I'm not putting words into your mouth.
We are definitely encouraging the state legislature and calling on the state legislature and the governor to support a ban on all forms of fracking, including matrix acidizing. 90 cities and counties have opposed fracking over the years. It's a process that threatens our waterways, uses water sand and chemicals to unleash the oil or gas trap beneath the Earth's surface. And for the last couple of years, as you know, Sean, there have been bills sponsored by Republicans and Democrats, so bipartisan, to ban all three forms of fracking. And unfortunately,
Senator Dana Young was the sponsor last year, if I'm not mistaken, from Tampa.
Absolutely. And Representative Kathleen Peters of St. Petersburg in Pinellas County. This year so far, the bills that are moving forward only ban two out of three forms of fracking. Matrix acidizing is likely the form of fracking that's most likely to occur in Florida because of our geology. And so the solution is really simple, though, right? Ban all three forms. We don't have a ton of this type of drilling here in Florida. So unlike states like Texas or Pennsylvania, we have the opportunity to be forward thinking and protect our state from these dangerous fossil fuels and the dangerous forms of extraction in particular. So we're calling with the Floridians Against Fracking Coalition and elected officials, hundreds of elected officials across the state, thousands of Floridians, tens of thousands of Floridians to ban all three forms.
I'm going to take on the role of the cynic for a moment mm-hmm. and say, what if you're a Florida legislature who hearts oil and gas drilling, but you wanted to look like you're a tough environmentalist. You could say, "Hey, I voted to ban fracking," and yet you voted for these two types, but not to ban the type that's most likely to be used in Florida. Is that cynical view? Is that a possibility? Could that be happening?
Well, anything could happen in Tallahassee, Sean. but yeah, it could happen, and I would consider that greenwashing, right? I mean, we've folks who work on this issue, groups that work on this issue, experts who've weighed in on this issue, including geologists from NRDC and others, all are in a consensus that to really ban fracking in Florida, we need to ban all three forms. And so that's why we're calling on the legislature to do just that. There's a lot of challenges that we face when it comes to water quality in Florida. I mean, just an endless amount, as we've already discussed on this show. This is something the legislature and the governor can do right off the bat to protect Floridians and our water for future generations. And in fact, I believe that the state legislature and the governor want to do just that, that they want to ban fracking. Again, sometimes the devil's in the details, but there is consensus that this is the way to do it. So I hope they'll lead and protect our state from this threat.
But as of right now, it's just the ban on the two forms of fracking and not the one that's most likely to happen in Florida. So people should kind of keep an eye on this if they're interested in the topic of fracking in Florida.
Absolutely. And in fact, I would say that today is the time to call both your state representative and your state senator and really the governor as well, right, to urge them to tackle this issue, pass this ban this year. They have two and a half, three weeks to do that. They absolutely can. Now is the time that we need to be weighing in with them to make it happen.
And I want to use this as a jumping off point. So we're talking about fracking. Typically, what that would be exploration to get natural gas out of the ground. Mm-hmm. And natural gas, a lot of it's been billed as a clean fuel. But why do you oppose extraction of natural gas? And maybe you can answer that in terms of climate change. Why would you, with someone who is concerned about climate change and the effects of climate change, be also concerned that natural gas might not be the answer?
Sure. Well, natural gas is probably, natural is not quite, I think, implies a lot of things that natural gas is actually not. So when we think about tackling climate change, big picture, we want to move away from fossil fuels that include natural gas, coal, from burning fossil fuels, and to empowering our communities and our society with 100% clean renewable energy, and not all renewable sources also have equal benefits for society and the environment. So, for example, when we think of truly clean renewable energy, that's energy that's virtually pollution-free. So electricity generation that creates minimal or no pollution. It's energy that's inexhaustible. That means it comes from, it's practically unlimited. Energy that's safe, so that the permanent impacts to community safety, to public health, to the environment and wildlife are eliminated and temporary, and the impacts are really minimized. And energy that's efficient, so it represents a wise use of our resources. And natural gas does not fit under that. Right, burning coal does not fit under that. Nuclear, in fact, does not fit under that. Solar, wind, which we have plenty of solar potential here in Florida, absolutely does. And right now, Florida currently gets less than 1% of our energy from solar, which, as we all know, as the Sunshine State, is embarrassing. We can do a lot better. And thankfully, cities are really, given the lack of federal and currently state leadership on this issue, are really taking up the mantle of moving our communities towards more renewable sources.
Well, let's talk about cities right now. Our guest is Jennifer Rubiello, the State Director of Environment Florida. And this coming Thursday, so just a few days, St. Petersburg will vote on its Integrated Sustainability Action Plan. And the goal there, what it would do is would reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 20% by 2020, so that's just next year, and have 100% clean energy by 2035 with a social equity component that might be missing in some other types of plans. So what can you tell our listeners about the Integrated Sustainability Action Plan that's going to be voted on Thursday in St. Petersburg?
Well, we're really excited about the plan. Again, there are seven cities in Florida that have made so far commitments to transition to 100% renewable energy. St. Petersburg, along with other cities in the I-4 corridor, is like Orlando, really leading the way. And so this...
I noticed you didn't mention Tampa.
No, Tampa, I know. Where is Tampa at on this? Tampa should be leading the way as well. That's a good question. Where is Tampa on this?
Well, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Yeah. Good point. There's Largo, there's Dunedin, there's Orlando, St. Petersburg, Sarasota. But the thing about the St. Petersburg plan, things that we like about it, for example, is that it specifies that nuclear energy, waste energy, and natural gas will not be included in the city's commitment to 100% renewable energy by 2035, which we like. It also lays out specific goals for improving energy efficiency, which is a big part of this transition. So we need to transition to 100% renewable energy for all the reasons I mentioned earlier. But a part of that is actually first being more efficient about the energy that we currently use. And that's a big piece of this transition. And so this plan would reduce citywide energy demands 25% by 2025 and 35% by 2035. And it also includes a vision for working towards a net zero energy building code for new construction, essentially make it easier to have renewables on our new on buildings moving forward.
So if someone is out there and they're listening and they're maybe in St. Petersburg or near St. Petersburg and they're really interested in this issue, what can you tell them about Thursday? Where can they go or who can they call?
Absolutely. So the biggest thing, if you are in or near St. Petersburg, if you're particularly a resident of St. Petersburg, and you are free starting at 3 p.m. on Thursday, April 18th, show up to, believe it'll be at City Hall or the current City Hall to show your support. And there will be opportunities to speak, so folks can certainly do that. Showing up is meaningful and important. And for folks who perhaps have a day job and can't make it, you can also email council@stpete.org to weigh in and support of this plan. Again, local communities are really where we're going to be seeing a lot of the actual transition away from fossil fuels and towards clean energy. And it's very exciting that St. Petersburg is showing such great leadership on an issue that really is existential for our community. I think all of us want to live in a city, many of us want to live in a city where clean energy powers our homes, our schools, our buildings, and that's resilient so that we can continue to live there for future generations.
And in this plan, it's not just the environment, it's also about social equity. What do you know about the social equity component of this plan?
Well, transitioning towards more renewable energy means thinking about how resiliency in energy actually impacts people in their daily lives. And so one of the things that the plan has specifically outlined as a priority as it moves forward is making sure that decisions that are made take into account the equity piece, right? So making that a forefront in decision making. More broadly, a lot of times, really climate impacts, right? Like dirty energy impacts vulnerable communities the most. And so the more that we are mindful of that moving forward as we design our cities in a more resilient, sustainable way, that is fair and equitable to everyone and prioritizes those that are most vulnerable, the better off it will be for the long run.
So that's this Thursday beginning at 3 at St. Petersburg City Hall. 5th Avenue North, if I'm not mistaken, is where.
Yep, I encourage everyone to
I shouldn't be talking off the cuff. I interrupted you. Go ahead.
We'll post it. We'll post it on the website, the
exactly.
exact location for
yeah.
and the Facebook event for folks to show up.
Yes, I think it's on 5th Street, and I had that wrong, and I apologize. Well, let's go to the phones. We haven't gone to the phones in a while, so it's Scott in Clearwater. You're on the air. What would you like to say, and thanks for holding?
Yeah, it's my understanding that the state of Florida doesn't have a comprehensive growth plan. They've got guidelines that municipalities, can use, but it's not anything they have to go through. And then I just found out that in 2015, there was a bill passed that municipalities don't even have to go through their regional commissions. I guess the state is broken up into development commissions, regional, I forget what the exact name is called, regional economic or something like that. I don't know. But I really think that with the current growth that we have here in Florida and the growth that's on the books, there's probably no recovering, especially with they're already, injecting wastewater down in South Florida into the wells. They're talking about doing it into Tampa. And, it's looking pretty grim for Florida. I just came from, I just drove over to Kathleen, Florida the other day.
Near Lakeland.
Kayak. And they've got a ban there. They've got a protest going on there. It's savekathleen.org over to, they're complaining about the overdevelopment there. And actually the people that I bought a kayak over there, they're leaving the state because of all the development there. And what's happened is one region, one county, one city, whatever development they have there affects the others. And we don't have a comprehensive plan monitoring this growth between regions and between counties and between cities. And so if, out there in Polk County or the center of the state around the Green Swamp, if the development's on a rampage there, it's going to affect the water downstream, which is mostly our coastal areas, And I just don't think our legislators are really looking at the whole picture. And it's all pro-development right now, and it's really sad,
Well, Scott, thanks. Thank you for those perspectives. Let's hear what our guest, Jennifer Rubiello from Environment Florida, has to say about growth in Florida.
Sure. Again, growth is a huge part of we have to think smartly about how we grow in this state. We're a really big state. We have a lot of land, increasingly more and more people who want to come here because of our waterways, the sunshine, perhaps no state income tax, who knows? But there's lots of reasons to come here that Florida is obviously a very special place. And as more and more people do come here and the state continues to grow, we have to, again, think about how we organize our communities to be to move away from sprawl and towards more dense urban areas, because that will have less of an environmental impact.
Our guest is Jennifer Rubiello from Environment Florida, and your group has put out two reports recently talking about renewables in cities is one, and at universities is another. So why don't we talk about those two right now? What's your preference to talk about first? How universities ranked for renewable energy, or how cities did?
Sure. Let's start with cities, because we were talking about that earlier. So as I mentioned, unfortunately, we're not seeing quite the leadership that we would like at the federal and currently the state level when it comes to moving towards renewable energy. So we recently, thankfully, though, cities and local institutions, so cities, universities, and even businesses all across the country are taking really proactive steps to demand more renewables and to put more renewables on the line. And actually, you know, we were railing about Tampa a little bit earlier, but in a recent report that we just put out that called Solar Cities, which is the most comprehensive survey available of installed solar capacity in major U.S. cities, Tampa ranks 33 nationwide for solar energy capacity per capita. So it's leading amongst our region, the Southeast region, for installing clean energy from the sun. Again, that's within the actual city of Tampa. So Tampa's doing some good things. Other cities like Jacksonville's leading the way in the state. Other cities like Miami and Orlando, certainly the cities themselves made the list. So we're seeing a lot of progress there. This is the sixth year we've put out this report. And even cities like, even smaller cities like Tallahassee and are going big on solar energy. So Tallahassee, for example, has enough solar PV capacity installed to be ranked as a leading solar star. So it's a smaller city, but still taking some big steps forward when it comes to renewables. So that's, I think, means that cities like Tampa, for example, should commit to even more and are well positioned to do so. And I think that is exciting. The other piece here is that universities, right, are leading the way nationwide when it comes to this transition. We, again, in a recent report ranking universities for how much renewable energy they have on the line. So we ranked cities across universities across the country. And to date, 40 colleges and universities are entirely powered by 100% renewable energy. 40. None in Florida yet. But this is a really huge opportunity for our universities here in Florida to be leading in that transition. These are the think tanks of our state. They're places of innovation, of expertise. Actually, on Friday, I sat in on a student, Sarah Sim, who's at Florida State University, who is defending her honors thesis on how the city of Tallahassee is going to transition to 100% renewable energy. So her whole honors thesis was on the cost of that. Turns out, cost of solar to do that is quite possible and quite low. So again, our universities can be the hubs of where this transition happens.
Our guest is Jennifer Rubiello with Environment Florida. You're listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF Tampa, WMNF.org. My name is Sean Canan, and this is Midpoint Monday, and we're talking about all sorts of things that are happening on the environmental front in Florida, especially with regards to the legislature, which is still in session. Maybe I should ask you about the bans on single-use plastic, and there are efforts in St. Petersburg and other places to ban straws, and some places are banning plastic bags. And then when you go up to the state legislature, they think that that's the worst thing that could ever possibly happen, is that a local government might decide its own rules. And so what Tallahassee says is that they're trying to preempt the local governments from having these local ordinances. What's happening in Tallahassee right now with preemption?
So many things, but when it comes to specifically preempting single-use plastics, so again, big picture, local communities We have a plastics problem in the state and in this country. We're literally addicted to plastics. We use items like styrofoam cups and takeout containers or plastic bags or single-use plastic straws once, and then we throw them away, and they potentially can end up in our landfills or even in our oceans for hundreds of years. That has to change. That has to change, particularly so that we can ensure that the oceans that we swim in, right, have wildlife that is healthy for years to come. I think most of us have seen the headlines of whales, right, washing up on shore that have just pounds and pounds of plastic in them. So in order to do that, though, we need to move away from the worst form of plastics. And again, particularly the types of items that we just use once and then throw away. So again, styrofoam cups, takeout containers, plastic bags, single-use plastic straws. And unfortunately, even though our local communities want to, our local governments, some of them want to protect their communities from plastics pollution, both the impact it has on wildlife, but also the public health angle, right? We're eating plastic, essentially, right? Because it breaks down into tiny pieces. Fish and different animals eat it. We then eat that too. So there's potential impacts there. Local governments are working to move us away from using some of these items. And unfortunately, the state government, right, our state legislature, has tied the hands of those local communities being able to take proactive steps to protect themselves. And so one, lifting those what we call preemptions is a top priority. Right now, the state legislature has preempted styrofoam and plastic bags, and right now they're moving forward with taking away local communities' ability to regulate single-use plastic straws.
813-239-9663. If you'd like to join this conversation, why don't we take a phone call? Right now we have Brittany in Tampa. Hi, Brittany.
Hello. I was just calling with a quick comment. I have been born and raised Tampa. My family is born and raised Tampa. We've been here generations. My parents live out in Valrico, and on the street that they live on, it is still, thankfully, well, not anymore, but it used to be still very nature forward. A lot of trees, a lot of wildlife. My parents have owls in their backyard. I've seen coyotes in their backyard in the heart of Valrico. And a couple years ago, they had a developer come in wanting to buy up some backyard properties, essentially, and start a new development. And, of course, they did, like, the city meeting postings, whatever. So everyone rallied together, and they all came in, and they said, hey, this isn't what we want for our area. And then about a month or two ago, some developer came in secretly, bought everything secretly. And within like the last month, they have taken down acres and acres of dense forest. My parents are lucky if they hear an owl once a week now, whereas you used to hear multiple owls every single night. And it's just devastating. And I just don't, I mean, I know we can talk to our legislature, but I don't know how to stop like this shady secret, kind of development where people are coming in under the rug and under the carpet because they know that the people that live here don't want it, but yet the only way to get it done and to get the money and the profit in their pocketbooks is to do it secretly.
All right. Thank you for that call, Brittany. Let's see what Jennifer has to say.
It's devastating. Absolutely. It's devastating. The developers do have a lot of power in this state, and stories like that in particular not only are heartbreaking, but I definitely need to be elevated more. So I would definitely encourage you to call your state legislators, both state senators, state representatives, to let them know that this is happening.
Well, Jennifer, what's the last thing you would leave people with if they're following the environment in Florida and they are interested in the legislative session? What could you recommend for people to pay attention to?
Sure. Well, first of all, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, environmentflorida.org as well, our website. We post all of our information reports, press releases that we just mentioned, I just mentioned today there. And certainly lots of our partners as well have some really helpful resources. I think the key thing is to stay tuned and informed and make sure that you're calling and weighing in as these decisions are being made. There's a lot of lobbyists in Tallahassee that don't represent interests that protect the public and the environment, and so it's really on us as community members to make our stories like the one we just heard and voices heard so that we can counter that.
Well, thanks so much for joining us on 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa today, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Rubiello is the State Director of Environment Florida, and I want to thank everyone who called, emailed, and texted today. Ed in Lakeland, sorry I did not get to you. Jay in St. Pete, sorry I didn't get to you. You can still leave a voicemail with your thoughts. Call me at 813-238-8001, extension 114. I'll play your message next show. Thanks to our engineers Alvaro Montealegre and Frank Knox. I'm Sean Canaan. Tomorrow at noon, your hero Mark Bureau will host Midpoint Tuesday. Stay tuned now for Executive Session with John Gilmore coming up after NPR headlines on WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, Lakeland. Thanks so much for listening.